I'll call the pre-council meeting of the Columbia City Council to order. And our first item tonight will be our annual ethics refresher course from our city attorney, Nancy Thompson.
Good evening. It is my pleasure to be here with you this evening. We talk about it being ethics training, but ethics at its very core is about decision making. We've expanded the topic just a little bit to cover ethics, conflicts of interest, sunshine, council procedures, and just about anything else that you all want to talk about as it relates to process and procedure of local government in Columbia. Because in Columbia, we do have a few nuances that are unique to us, not necessarily unique nationwide, but in Columbia as a charter city. So cities derive their power from the state legislature. In general, we have to be consistent with what the state legislature provides, but indefinitely we have to be consistent with the Constitution. We're a charter city. There are also statutory cities, and those statutory cities can only do what is allowed by the state of Missouri for statutory cities. As a constitutional charter city, our residents drafted their own charter, the voters approved that charter, and we basically can do anything that's allowed under state law for any city of any particular type of classification. So very broad powers granted to us as a charter city, and I think that's really important to remember as you do your legislative activities, because that's the framework within which we all operate. The city charter was drafted, and to me, it's really important to understand the idea behind the framers of our charter. And I'm just going to read it because it sets the backdrop. We, the citizens of the City of Columbia, Missouri, in order to secure the benefits of constitutional home rule under the Constitution of the State of Missouri, maintain a democratic form of government, establish the basic governmental structure of the city, maintain an economical city manager form of city administration, provide for full publicity and openness in the conduct of affairs of the city government, public meetings and records, provide for equality of citizenship for all Columbians, and promote the common welfare, do ordain and establish this home rule charter for the City of Columbia. So it's really important to understand that is openness, transparency. Those really date back in Columbia's history, and it's a piece of what you see throughout all of our city code and the way that we operate, as is the equality for all citizens, which is part of the City Council's strategic plan for the city as well, still today. As a city manager form of government, it combines the strong political leadership of a city manager the strong political leadership of the city council and elected officials with the managerial experience of a appointed professional city manager. The role of the city manager is to submit an annual statement of policy recommendations for programs and priorities that benefit the city. Your city manager is responsible for budget preparation. He provides annual financial reports. He's the chief advisor to the city council. By charter, the city manager has the capacity to engage in debate with the city council, but not vote. The role of the council is to focus on the community goals, major projects, community growth, land use development, capital improvement financing, and strategic planning. The mayor is one of several council members, but is elected at large, serves as a voting member of the city council, has no veto, no regular administrative duties, but is the policy leader by virtue of the fact that the mayor is elected at large, presides over the council meetings, and then is head of government for all ceremonial purposes as well. Guiding principles of ethics are really that elected officials are in positions to serve the public, not for the personal benefit. And I think everybody in this room really understands that charge as an elected official. public resources are entrusted to elected officials to serve the public and not for private benefit. So that's really the overarching piece of ethics. It's also, I think sometimes we forget that the ethics laws don't just apply to the elected officials, but they apply to the appointed public officials. All public employees are responsible for complying with conflict of interest laws as well. We have people who have rulemaking authority in the city. Anybody with rulemaking authority is responsible for complying. Judicial positions, that would be Judge Nose, who is one of your employees. And people who are in serving quasi-judicial capacities, such as your Board of Adjustment.
CPRB a quasi-judicial?
CPRB makes recommendations, so they're not quasi-judicial. Recommending boards are not considered to be quasi-judicial. You do have appeals that go to your Building and Construction Codes Commission, which are quasi-judicial because they issue a final determination in those. Your Building and Construction Codes Commission is also an entity with rulemaking authority, as is the Planning Commission.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. The Planning and Zoning Commission also has some authority.
Right. Some of those higher, you know, when we talked previously about the CNBC technology necessary for certain types of boards and commissions, those with that elevated authority are generally those that have rulemaking authority, if you can kind of think of it in those terms. Lots of places where we find ethics laws. You know, officials are subject to laws that are applicable to the general public. There are also laws related to duty in public office, such as you can't bribe a public servant, acceding to corruption, obstructing government operations, official misconduct, misuse of official information. We're going to talk a little bit about those, but I'm not going to go into anything too depth because we just plain don't have the time this evening. I'd probably put you to sleep if I haven't already. So apologize in advance, but the conflict of interest laws are all found in Chapter 105. Missouri Constitution also contains obligations and ethics for public officials, in particular nepotism. And then we have state laws that are related to operations of political subdivisions, and those are found in chapters 71 through 100 of the revised statutes, and our Columbia City Charter and City Code are also sources of information that you need to be familiar with. So launching right into that, there are some nuances in our city charter that are important to keep at the forefront. First and foremost, the Columbia City Charter has a non-interference clause. In the preamble, we talked about the city manager form of government. All of those powers are delegated to the city manager. Council members may not interfere or request the appointment or removal of officers or employees pursuant to the city charter. Council members may make inquiry of administrative officials, but when you make inquiry, it can't sound like jeopardy. You can't be actually forming the answer giving the answer in the form of a question. That is still directing a city employee. It is what the city employee perceives the council member is doing as to whether or not it is a directive that's being given. So best advice is that you, if you have requests, you need to do those through the city manager's office. The city manager has a system set up with the fellows, and then I know he meets with you on a regular basis, and you can make those requests at that time. Just be cautious about giving requests directly to city employees.
Just have a question. In the long past, in the early days, I can remember being asked by a former city manager my opinion of a hiring of a city employee. And frankly, I was put on report by the mayor at that time. And it came back from the city attorney that it wasn't interference, but it was meddling. when you're asked a question by a city manager, is it not fair game to answer the question, or should you defer to answer that question, even if you're asked that question?
I think if you're asked the question, it's fair game to answer that question. But what you want to be sure of is that you haven't inserted yourself into that process indirectly by saying, don't you believe it would be good to have a city council person weigh in on this? You know, there are other factors that can come into play, but if it is a pure request from a city manager, I don't believe that's a charter violation.
I'm not expecting you to define meddling. I'm not sure what that ever was, but
sure. It's important because it results in forfeiture of office. Now, we're going to talk about automatic forfeiture of office. This would require an investigation and likely done by the Missouri Ethics Commission based upon a potential charter violation. We haven't had to go through this. If we have to, it's never an easy process. Council has three employees: the city manager, the city clerk, and the municipal judge. Those are the only three employees that the council has direct authority over, which is why it's very important to go through the city manager on any other issues. You can obviously ask the city clerk for things directly, and you can talk with the municipal judge. The municipal judge has to maintain judicial integrity as well, so you can't actually give directives to the municipal judge, but it is an employee of the council. The municipal judge is appointed to a specific term. The city manager and city clerk both serve for indefinite terms. The one sole exception to that is that when it comes to the city councilor is actually appointed by the city manager with the consent of the city council. When I was hired, I went through an approval process. And the same way happens when it comes to removal of the city councilor. The city councilor is removed with the advice and consent of the city council. Presumably that's so that the city councilor can have independence of judgment. If the council needs to consult with me or my office, you have that capacity to do so without being concerned, or without me being concerned, that the city manager could terminate me for talking with a council member and providing unbiased legal advice. Another charter provision: conflict of interest. Section 156 of the charter actually references back to state law, but the focus on the charter is on contracts or sales to the city of land, materials, supplies, or services. If there is found to be a conflict of interest, then it is a forfeiture of office. And we're going to get into the conflict of interest pieces a little bit farther in the presentation. Then lastly, contained within the city charter is a provision regarding campaign financing, and you are required to comply with the state law on campaign practices and financing and conduct of elections. It's not automatic forfeiture, but the council itself may order the office of any candidate who doesn't comply with the campaign financing and conduct of election requirements to forfeit office. Okay, so how do we act? You can only act at an official meeting. As a group, you're one of seven, and you act as a body of seven. Sometimes city managers will say, unless four people tell me that this is what they want, then we're not going to move in that direction, because you have to reach consensus as this governing body in order to provide direction to the city manager, and in order for the city manager then to provide direction to city staff. So when one of you goes, if one of you were to go outside of what I call the city council box, which is acts of the council as a whole, individual acts don't bind a city. It's only when you act as the city council. And our charter has a specific provision that says that the city council's acts don't have any legal effect unless the vote takes place at a meeting that's open to the public. It's a little bit unusual for a municipality. There are some municipalities that may act in closed session, may take votes in closed session. Our city council can reach consensus, and the mayor or the city manager can act on that consensus, but it doesn't really have legal effect until there's a vote at an open meeting that's open to the public. So just keep that in the back of your mind when it comes to actions. I think all of you have been involved in public meetings now for some time. I know that Ms. Wehner is new to the council, but has been involved in boards and commissions for a long time and has received education on Sunshine Law. So I'm going to click through these quickly. You can't have a quorum of the public body or of the city council together to discuss public business except at an official meeting. That's probably the biggest thing to remember. When four of you are gathered together, you need to make sure that you're not talking official business of the city, that it's for social purposes only, or that you happen to be at a meeting that was actually properly noticed under the Sunshine Law. And all of the requirements and bells and whistles of the Sunshine Law have to be met in order for that to occur. Sunshine Law, in addition to the open meetings, applies to public records. The City of Columbia has a transparency policy, which makes sure that we have full transparency to the public and that the Sunshine Law is broadly interpreted when it comes to a release of records that may be, if we start to look at something and say, well, we could argue one way or the other, we land on the side of transparency. If you transmit a message regarding public business, you should copy the city clerk if it's not done on your public email account. If it's done on a private email account, or you can always copy your public email account instead of the city clerk, but all of your email and electronic transmissions should go through a public resource in order to ensure that we have that transparency. Another thing to be aware of is that your text messages on personal phones are also subject to the Sunshine Law if they are a topic of public business. So just because it happens to be a personal device or personal email account doesn't mean that it's not a public record. In order to protect yourself to the greatest extent possible, you want to make sure that you are using your public resources for those kinds of messages. There are 22 exceptions to the Sunshine Law for closed meetings and closed records. The exceptions are read narrowly in the spirit of transparency. Primarily in the City of Columbia, we utilize the exception of personnel, labor unions, legal actions, leasing, purchasing of real estate, but there are more out there, but those are really the more common ones that you'll see as a council member. In order to go into a closed session, we have to have a roll call vote. Your vote has to be recorded in the minutes. We have to have this specific exception for which the council is going into closed session. It can't be just a listing of things that might happen to come up during closed session. We have on here record each member's vote taken during closed session, but in Columbia we don't actually vote during closed session, so that's not applicable in Columbia. And then when you are in closed session, you need to just always be cognizant of the fact that you cannot discuss any business which doesn't relate to the specific reason for that closed session. Sunshine law violations. If you knowingly violate the sunshine, you're subject up to a civil penalty of $1,000, or the city is subject to that penalty, and the court may order the payment of costs and attorney fees. The difference for purposefully violating is there's a higher fine for purposefully violating, which is $5,000, and the court, the law says that the court shall award attorney fees and costs for purposeful violation. And then the factors in determining the size of the civil penalty is the size of the jurisdiction, the seriousness of the offense, and whether or not there were prior violations.
I just have a question about the what can be discussed given that you've declared that you're going to discuss. For example, if you declare that you're going to discuss real estate, and maybe even a specific piece of real estate was intended for the discussion, can any real estate under those circumstances real estate related topic come up? I understand others can't, personnel and some of the others, but
correct. Yes, you can. You can talk about any tract of real estate when it comes to purchase, sale, or leasing, where public, I think the phrase is where public knowledge of the transaction could be a detriment. Okay, on to decision making. Now that we've figured out how to have a meeting and what some of the parameters are for holding a meeting, we're going to talk about types of decisions that get made by council. You can make legislative decisions. You can make administrative decisions. Legislative decisions are when the council is making the rules. The administrative decisions are when you're applying the rules. So, for example, of a legislative decision is when you're adopting zoning regulations to include in the Unified Development Code. Or when you're adopting per parcel zoning is actually a legislative decision as well. When you are adopting subdivision regulations to include in the UDC, those are legislative decisions. Adoption of licensing regulations are legislative decisions. Administrative decisions are where you apply the rules and you have much more limited discretion. You have broad discretion in legislation and legislative acts. Examples of your administrative decisions are platting. Platting is an administrative decision. You're applying the rules that have previously been adopted by your legislative acts. Issuance of liquor license. Now, this council doesn't issue liquor licenses, but some councils do. And that's where you're applying the rules that have already been put into place. And what's important about those two acts is that if we were ever to be challenged on an act of the city council, the court takes a look at what type of action you were, what type of legislative authority you were actually exercising, and if it is legislative, you're presumed to be correct, and your actions are only overturned if it's arbitrary and unreasonable. If you are exercising an administrative act as a council, then there is no presumption of validity, and the review is done on the record. So the court will actually take a look at the facts and uphold it if there's substantial and competent facts to support your decision. Council acts in a variety of ways. Commonly, you'll have a motion, you'll have a resolution, a policy resolution, or an ordinance. All of those have different procedures that are attached to them. We don't normally put motions on your council agenda. That's normally something that council raises on its own. When staff presents something to you, which is of an and emotions are for things that are of administrative nature, resolutions, when staff brings something forward to you, we normally will put those administrative decisions or administrative directives into a written resolution for your review and consideration. City of Columbia requires that resolutions have two readings, both of which may occur at the same council meeting and may occur by bill number only. Policy resolutions, however, are enacted like an ordinance, and they require three readings and must be done at two separate meetings of council that are at least a week apart. Ordinances are the same way, three readings at least a week apart before enactment. City charter in Columbia requires that there be an affirmative vote of a majority of the entire council in order to adopt any ordinance, resolution, or motion. So it takes four affirmative votes of this body. If there's less than a quorum present, it still takes four affirmative votes. Yes?
You said three readings on an ordinance. So we put it on first read, and Sheila reads it. Then it comes back for a public hearing. When's the third reading? A second time before we vote?
It comes back on, there's potential public comment. If it is on the consent agenda, those are read by the clerk once, and then they're read by the clerk a second time before they're adopted.
Yes.
And if it's done as an item of old business, then you actually do have two readings in there. It's when it's brought up as an item of old business, it's read the first time, and prior to vote, it's read the third time.
Okay, thank you.
And those can occur by bill number only. So sometimes that's, you know, when Sheila is very, very good at reading those bill numbers in a cadence.
I know, it's impressive.
You know, fortunately, with the internet today, there's access to that the agendas in advance, and so it really is helpful to people to be able to have advance notice of what we're voting on, because most of the public doesn't know the bill numbers. But for expediency, we'd be here all night if we read every single bill title of every single bill.
Yeah, Sheila could make a career out of commercials. You know, these fast speaking commercials that people.
Well, I've been doing this a long time, and I have to tell you that the state law changed in, I should have this date down. I want to say the early 90s, that it used to be that you had to read every bill in its entirety. Oh. Now, as a charter city, Columbia may not have had to have done that, but under state law, fourth-class cities had to do it, and each bill had to be read in its entirety. We would put them on recording, because it had to be read three times. We'd put it on a recording, and that recording would be going on in the background while we continued on, and it'd be on a fast play, because there's no other way you could get your business done on a
recording. We treat Sheila very well. She doesn't have to do that.
I think those would have been days that would date myself. When it comes to your levels of discretionary authority, and this really plays into the legislative authority and the administrative authority, because in the level of discretion that you have when you take various types of acts. So you have your discretionary acts, your ministerial acts, and your quasi-judicial acts. In general, your quasi-judicial acts have a statutorily mandated public hearing. Councilperson Fowler you mentioned a public hearing on our ordinances. Those are not, technically speaking, public hearings. Those are opportunities for public comment unless there's a statutorily required public hearing. Our city charter requires us to allow the public to comment on every ordinance or bill that comes before the governing body. So we don't, from a legal standpoint, we like to differentiate between what is a public hearing and what is a public comment. So all bills receive public comment or have an opportunity for the public to comment prior to enactment. Then you have your statutorily mandated public hearing, on certain types of items, and an annexation proceeding is an example of that.
Like one of the ones that we have tonight.
That is correct. And there are specific statutory rules that apply to how those have to be held or what time frame they have to be held. For example, a public hearing on an annexation is required to be held at least 14 days in advance of council action. So you have those, and then you don't take action the same night. There are other types of action where you may actually have the public hearing and the bill with council action on it on the same night. But staff takes care of all that for you. You don't have to worry about the details other than to know there might be a reason why we don't have that bill on the same night as the public hearing. What's important about public hearings are that you do have procedural due process as well as substantive due process, which invokes the notice opportunity to be heard. You are an independent, impartial decision-making body. You cannot make up your mind before a public hearing. So if you are approached by a constituent, or multiple constituents, it's important that you not form an opinion until after the public hearing, because you never know what's going to be presented. There may be something presented at a public hearing that could totally change your mind. And that's the whole purpose of providing both the applicant and the public with the notice and opportunity to be heard on an issue before you vote. Anything that you gain outside of that public hearing, any information you gain upon which you might be making your decision, should be disclosed on the record. That provides, again, everyone with a notice and opportunity to be heard based on all of the information. If it's presented again during the public hearing, you don't have to disclose it, you know, second, third, fourth time. It just needs to make sure it's on the record, at least at some level, if it's an item upon which you're going to base your decision. That's a slide on that. Land use decisions. By far, most of the controversial things that you're going to have come before you are land use decisions. I mean, we have a lot of ordinances that we enact as well, having to do with regulatory matters, but most of them also deal with land use decisions, whether it's short-term rental, whether it's your medical marijuana regulations, whether it is payday loans, or in the instance of an annexation, like this evening, most items that come before you that are controversial are of that nature. So I just point out what the legislative land use decisions are and what the administrative land use decisions are. And then on the next few slides, what I go through are what, and I will provide you with a copy of this presentation as well so that you have it. But when it comes to annexation, which is a legislative decision, these are the factors that you should be considering for an annexation request. For zoning, these are the factors. You are always involved, again, with due process rights of individuals, because you're dealing with people's property rights. Some important stuff. So the zoning considerations are the character of the neighborhood, the zoning and uses of the surrounding property, the detrimental effect that the change in zoning would have on other property in the area, the adaptability of the property for the current permitted use, traffic congestion, public safety, density, preservation of features of historical significance, existence of adequate infrastructure.
You apply the same standards to a replat, or is this simply a rezoning?
This is rezoning. It does not apply to platting. If there's, you know, a lot of times you'll get a land use application that has multiple requests tied to it, whether it is both rezoning and replatting or annexation as well. Yes. Yeah,
there's always been a controversy. It's an ongoing controversy. I'm not sure there's an answer to it, but whether or not to separate zoning decisions from plan decisions, and some folks are advocates for combining them both in the same bill, if you will, and some folks are advocates for separating them. Any comments on?
Sometimes they're contingent upon each other, particularly when you have a plan development. Your zoning really should be determined based upon these factors. I will tell you that a property owner is not entitled to highest and best use of their property. You get that phrase thrown around a lot when it comes to zoning decisions. A property owner is entitled to reasonable use of the property, and reasonable is determined by all of the factors. So I'd like to just erase highest and best use out of everyone's vocabulary. It's reasonable use of the property. So when it comes to rezoning to a plan district, you really have to bring forward both the site plan and the rezoning to a plan district at the same time. They can be separated, but they're really contingent upon each other because the appropriateness of the plan, determines whether or not the plan district is appropriate.
On the other
zoning.
Hand, these are one's a land use issue and the other is a it's a different issue, but
that is true.
I get it.
That is true. You know, technically speaking, once you've landed on the appropriate zoning, if it is straight zoning, your subdivision standards then come into play, and the subdivision standards control what the platting is. So you've turned into this, you've gone from zoning, which is the legislative decision, to the platting piece, which is the administrative. Now there are, you know, I say that and there are always a few caveats. So I just want to make sure that we understand that I'm giving you the general rule along with
a
few caveats.
That's the controversy.
That's the controversy. Well, we want to keep my fellow lawyers employed.
Yep. On plan developments, is it appropriate for a council member to negotiate any terms of that plan development, particularly between an applicant and, you know, potential other interested parties?
It's important for a council member to always maintain an open mind until after the matter comes before this body as a whole for consideration. Now, a council member may express what they like about a plan, but as far as negotiating and saying, I will vote yes if you do X, that's not something that a council member should do.
How about attempting to find sort of common ground?
Say that again?
Attempting to find common ground.
Right. So I think you can talk about that, but I also think you have to always preface every conversation with, you know, we haven't been through the public hearing on this. There are all sorts of things that could change my mind. And once we get through the public hearing, I'll make my final decision. I like this about your project. I don't like this about your project. These things concern me. But I've got to maintain an open mind until we get through the public hearing. I think you can express yourself. This isn't the laws aren't meant to mute council members, but you have to be careful how far you go with that because you can't make up your mind and say you're going to support a project until you've been through the public hearing and have heard all sides because you're just talking to one or two people at that point, maybe an applicant.
I think this is an incredibly important point at this point. I mean, as to how you deal with folks that come to you as city council members, both proponents and opponents of any particular proposal or anything that's on the table. And the approach, I think, a reasonable approach, and correct me if I'm wrong, is you can give folks advice as to what you think their strong points are, or what their weak points are, and so on and so forth. It's important not to to get to the point where you have concluded that you're going to support or oppose anything, because it happens all the time that you wind up in a city council meeting and there is new information that may change your mind. But that approach is something, I think, in terms of this expression that makes some sense, right? I mean, you can advise both sides, as regardless of what you think, if you're leaning in one particular direction or another, as to what their strong suit is or what their weak suit is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What you really want to stay away from is trying to get an applicant to commit to something in exchange for your support as a voting member of this body. You know, if an applicant ever asks you if that you will support their project, you want to run. Just going to say it. You can be willing to learn about their project. You can be willing to provide them some feedback, but best advice is never, ever, ever commit to support a project before it's been through the public hearing process and you have cast your vote in this room. So when it comes to plan developments, what we were just talking about, so plan developments are this hybrid between a subdivision and layout of the property through use of a site plan and zoning. So you really combine both the zoning and a site plan, and these are your considerations when it comes to what that site plan configuration is. When it comes to straight zoning, all of the platting requirements are set forth already in your city code as it relates in the subdivision regulations. There's a lot more give and take when it comes to a site plan. So if there's an applicant who wants to place its building closer to the street than what the normal subdivision standards would provide for or allow, then what we would want you to be considering is there something else that they're going to provide in exchange for that that smaller setback? Or if it's a rear setback line, is there additional screening from adjoining properties? Things along those lines. Usually there's some give and take that goes along with a site plan because the applicant's seeking something, some type of concession from what the normal development standards would be. And I think this may be to one of your earlier points as well. This is platting and subdivision. Subdivision is again similar to a site plan. They look a lot alike, except for a subdivision plat is governed by the regulations in the subdivision code. When you consider a plat, the only considerations set forth in your city code are lot configuration, street pattern, public spaces and common areas, and easements as it relates to the factors that the council takes a look at. Is that plat and is the lot configuration in conformity with the surrounding lots? And council does have the ability to make that determination as to whether or not you believe that it's in the lot configuration is appropriate based upon what's been presented to you and what's in the surrounding neighborhood. Is the street pattern, the street location appropriate? Have they provided public spaces and common areas? If it's a single lot type of plat, it's probably not so important to have the public spaces and common areas. But if you're looking at a 40-acre tract, that's certainly an important consideration. That's an impact on that type of growth is an impact on your neighborhoods and making sure there are public spaces and common areas and appropriate locations based upon what the layout and lot configuration is on a plat is an allowable consideration. In general, subdivision and plats are ministerial acts by the council if it meets the subdivision guidelines. It is something that is generally, you don't have a lot of discretion over whether or not you approve it. That is particularly true for a final plat versus a preliminary plat. You have greater, if in the continuum of discretionary authority, you have your greatest discretionary authority at a rezoning, and you have your least discretionary authority at the final plat stage. At the preliminary plat stage, you have greater discretionary authority to consider the lot configuration, street patterns, public spaces, and whether or not adequate public easements are provided for utilities.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The only exception to that has to deal with public safety. Is that true? I mean, in terms of whether it's preliminary plats or final plats, if there are issues of public, say, ingress and egress, those kinds of things, that may be a reason?
Perhaps, but you've got to look and see whether that's something new that has arisen since the original preliminary plat versus the final plat. So really do have this continuum. Yeah. We really have to look and see what that public safety concern is and find a way to articulate it.
There have been rare cases where the city council, some members of the city council have voted on ministerial actions to deny particular based on public safety. It is rare.
Right.
It
doesn't public happen. Health, safety, and welfare is always a consideration. Mm-hmm. Yep. And this, I think, gets to your point earlier on land use exactions and what council members can ask for, should ask for, should not ask for. This really should be done at the staff level, not necessarily at the council level. Staff doesn't get to vote, you get to vote. So at the staff level, at the council level, what city staff needs is for the city council to make sure that we have the enabling legislation in the city ordinances and the city code in order to get from an applicant the types of concessions that the city council wants on a non-discriminatory basis so that everybody's on a level playing field. And there has to be a rational nexus between the type of exaction that comes along with a land use decision. And that's really how it's determined whether or not there's going to be a constitutional exaction or one that is unconstitutional. So you have to have that relationship between what you're requesting and what the landowner is also requesting, what the council's requesting and what the landowner requests. Okay, going to switch gears a little bit to the use of public resources. So, do you have any questions about the land use decision making before I switch? Okay. Use of public resources. There is incidental private benefit is allowed when you are making decisions about public resources. So, for example, you can vote on a street improvement that is in your neighborhood. That's not an unlawful use of public funds to improve streets that happen to be in any council person's neighborhood. You're treated just like a member of the public. Now, if we were directing streets or directing funds directly to your house for a particular reason, that might be. But as long as you're treated as a member of the general public, that's just considered to be an incidental benefit. The city can't make charitable contributions. You are the gatekeepers of the public funds, and they have to be used for public benefit. Now, that doesn't mean that a charitable organization can't provide services to the city and that we can't enter into a services contract in exchange for payment, but we can't just make a contribution. So if the Boy Scouts comes to you and requests a $50,000 contribution, we have to turn them down. Now, we can decide whether or not we can get $50,000 worth of public benefit out of services provided by a charitable organization and enter into a contract with them for that. But it needs to be done, again, on an open basis. We may have to, depending upon how large of a public services contract it is will depend on whether or not we actually need to put those services out for bid before we enter into that type of arrangement. But as a municipality and keeper of public tax dollars, you don't just get to decide to give money to charitable organizations, which are private organizations. Another thing to be aware of is that you cannot use public funds to advocate, support, or oppose any ballot measure or a candidate for public office. And we're really strict about this. You've got to make sure that you're not using your city email account to solicit funds for your campaign. You're an elected official, so you have to be careful about that, because you have people who reach out to you for issues and they may want to support you, but the minute that somebody starts talking about wanting to support you as a candidate, you need to move that off of your city email account and say, I can't talk about this. This is my city email account. If you want to discuss, you know, that with me, do it over here and direct those to your private email, not your city email account, because otherwise you are using your public resources for a campaign purpose. Same way with a ballot issue. We are likely to have come up during your tenure a ballot issue on one or more items. You cannot ask for public support using your city email account or any city resources to vote yes on a ballot measure. You can provide factual information about what that ballot measure will do in the community, information that's been developed by the city to just push out factual information, but you cannot ask for support. You can't ask for a yes vote.
Yes. So I anticipate at least two ballot measures coming up this year. And one of them is already the subject of frequent email communications. I'm not the only one who gets emails about roll carts. So should that make the ballot and we continue to get the same volume of email we get about it, what's the most prudent thing for us to do about that? Is to just move it off of our council account?
No, I think what you have to be cautious about is not conducting a vote yes campaign or a vote no campaign using your city account. I mean, you can explain to your constituents your rationale for your legislative actions on placing something on the ballot if you choose to do it, or how it comes through, or comes back to council. You can absolutely explain that using your city account. What you can't do is encourage other people to vote a certain way using city resources. And I know it's kind of a fine line, and there are a lot of opinions by the Ethics Council on ballot measures and promotional pieces that have been put out by municipalities. And sometimes it's just a bit of a nuance. We can talk more about it as it gets closer to those specific issues, and we'll provide as much guidance as we can. The city normally will produce an informational brochure, which is acceptable to distribute.
So what you talked about sounds like it refers to a period of time when an issue is going to be on a ballot. Does it apply before that time? For example, using a city email account to encourage people to sign the petition to put a question on the ballot?
I'd have to give that one some thought.
Okay.
I would encourage you to not use your city account for anything that is ballot to encourage or try to influence the electoral process, whether it happens to be a ballot measure. I don't know that issue specifically has been determined by the Ethics Commission, but I can look to see if there's anything out there.
Okay, I'd be interested.
It's probably best to, just out of an abundance of caution.
I think out of an abundance of caution, it's best to not use your city email account at all.
Except for we have that whole period, the whole piece about sunshine and open records and transparency.
to give you an example of how far this can go, I can remember I learned a lesson learned a long time ago, very early on. I was a candidate for this city council office, and I was using my personal email account on my personal computer, but I was working for the university at the time. And I think the message went out at the time that I was working at the university to announce a fundraiser. That is not something you should do. There was a lot of grief for that, and I had to apologize profusely, but that's a lesson learned.
I'm gonna, because I know that you have a lot of issues that you need to get to this evening, I'm going to jump through a lot of slides, but I'm gonna give these, like I said, to you. Conflict of interest is generally anything that would, you're prohibited from participating in anything that will either directly or indirectly result in a financial gain to yourself, spouse, or dependent children. There are definitions for all of that. And most dependent children happen to be under 18 years of age, and I think a lot of people are still have dependents in their household that are much beyond that. Can't use confidential information to benefit yourself or a third party, which I think is really important. It isn't always about you. It can also be about someone else profiting from your knowledge, even if it's not you or yourself, spouse, or dependent child. You are required to report any type of financial transaction that you've had. The city clerk has forms for that. If you have to abstain in the city of Columbia, it's a specific rule that we have. There's an affirmative duty to vote in the city of Columbia, so you have to obtain the consent of your fellow council members before you're authorized to abstain from any particular matter. And all that has to happen before the item comes up for vote. Your personal financial disclosures, your campaign. I wanted to hit on this one. This is big. Nepotism. Nepotism is when an officer or an employee appoints someone within the fourth degree of affinity or consanguinity. Affinity is those who are your blood relatives. Consanguinity are those of your spouse. And if you appoint them, then it is automatic forfeiture of office. This one is do not pass go, do not collect $200. You can't get a do-over. You can't say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it. It applies. It does not have to be a paid position. It can be a volunteer position. And it's a very, very broad interpretation of employment. It applies to service contracts. So what you need to make sure is that you abstain from any of those decision makings. And you need to get out your family tree of yourself and your spouse. And if you have half-brothers or sisters, they all count in calculating that fourth degree of consanguinity or affinity. So it's very important that you get out that family tree and know who's in it.
Yes. That doesn't mean that it can't happen. For example, I mean, the city clerk very dutifully announced for example, my spouse was up for an appointment for a board of commission, board of health, and so on. I had to excuse myself because I cannot participate in that. Doesn't mean that those folks can't be appointed. It's just you cannot take part in that.
You cannot vote. If you vote, it is automatic forfeiture of office. This chart will show you how far that fourth degree of consanguinity or affinity reaches. It covers your great-great-grandparents and your great-great-grandchildren, aunts, uncles, first cousins. So just have an awareness. The city clerk does try to pay attention to that. I think it's pretty easy in Mr. Scala's case because the spouse he's referring to has the same last name. So in that instance, if someone with the name Scala comes up, I know that the city clerk is attuned to that. But that's not always the case today. Whether or not somebody is going to have the same last name, it could be something totally different. You may have a first cousin whose last name is similar but different and totally random.
Huh? And the same first name, too.
Exactly. Same first name. Sounds like, but not the same. And we're referring to your first cousin, I do believe.
Second cousin.
Yeah, so
in the municipal.
That's good because it's not on the list. But, you know, when it's a city employee, you're not involved in city in the appointment of city employees. So that's protected anyway. Violations. All complaints are made to the Missouri Ethics Commission. And there are protections for a complainant. There can't be any kind of adverse action taken against a complainant in those instances. And with that, I'm going to get to the end. Questions? Concerns?
I have one question regarding the ballot initiatives. Prior to being sworn in, I have notarized some of those petitions. At what point does that become an issue? Like, not at all because it wasn't in the same capacity?
Right. Okay. You did that before. It's all based on your point in time.
Got it.
A notary is purely an official act off to the side. I would recommend you not do it so that you don't.
Sure.
So it doesn't confuse the situation. I don't believe it to be a violation per se.
Yeah, I haven't notarized anything since filing, so we should be good. Thank you.
Thank you all for your attention. I'm sorry it took so.
Mr. Scala.
Just a note of recognition, I guess that's for you. When I first met you was, I think, 2007. I was first elected, and that was the orientation for elected officials. It was in Jeff City, as I can recall. Most of it had to do with Sunshine Law and so on. So it's been a long road.
It hasn't been a long road. I've changed my slides to black and gold.
Yeah, there it is. Indeed. Well, thank you for all of that and your contribution to the city's counselor's office.
Thank you.
Any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, I would like to move that the City Council of the City of Columbia, Missouri immediately go into closed meeting and conference room 1A, 1B of the City Hall to discuss the preparation, including in any discussions or work product on behalf of a public governmental body or its representatives for negotiations with employee groups pursuant to Section 610.021, subsection 9 of the Revised Statute of Missouri, and the hiring, firing, disciplining, or promoting of particular employees by a public governmental body when personal information about the employee is discussed or recorded pursuant to Section 610.021, subsection 3 of the Revised Statute of Missouri, and individually identifiable personnel records, performance ratings, or records pertaining to employees or applicants for employment pursuant to separate Chapter 610.021, subsection 13 of the Revised Statutes of Missouri is my motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Scala. Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Mr. Pitzer?
Yes.
Dr. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. Treese votes aye. Ms. Fowler?
Yes.
Ms. Wehner, how do you vote?
Yes.
We are in closed session, and we'll be back hopefully before 7:00.